Welcome to the 14th message of our series, Fight for Faith, a study of the life of David. Keep watching as we look at the path that can lead us from doubt to despair and ultimately to dysfunction when we go through extended periods of trials in our life.
Anyone who's been around the church for any period of time, especially anyone who's ever been in any kind of Christian bookstore, you know that there are certain verses in the Bible that seem to be the, you know, those popular verses that Christians not only have to quote, but will even put them on pictures with, you know, posters with pictures, and they almost become a kind of motivational poster. Let me give you a couple examples. And again, if you've been around, you almost could guess some of what these some of these verses may be. One example is this, you know, this picture with Matthew chapter 19:26, and the promise, with men, this is impossible, but with God, all things are possible. And we look at that, and you say, man, that's a beautiful promise. It's a beautiful verse. Or there's a great meaning and beauty in this picture that goes with this verse in Jeremiah chapter 1, in which reads, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. What a beautiful concept. But it seems like many of these favorite verses that we put on our walls, you know, they claim promises that are given to us, great promises that are given to us in the Bible. And so, for example, you know, Isaiah, here, Isaiah 41:13, you know, promise God's help in tough times. Or others like Jeremiah chapter 29:11, you know, I think probably one of the more common ones, you know, really talks about, you know, that God is with us. Or probably one of the most common is this one here in Philippians 4:13. You know, I can do everything through him who gives me strength. And people quote that. It's, you know, we almost treat it as kind of a self-help, you know, this whatever I put my mind to, if God is with me, then I can accomplish it. Now, I don't think that's what the verse actually means, but we quote it that way. And, you know, athletes will put it on their, you know, eye patches under their eyes, and boy, I can do everything. Now, as I said before, it's interesting that we do this, but there seems to be a certain kind of verse that we love to quote. You know, promises that talk about encouragement and God's going to be with us and he's going to bless us. But there are certain verses that seems like we never put on our walls. And, you know, I think, again, for an example, that is this one in John 6:16. You know, Jesus said, I have said these things to you that you may in me you may have peace. In this world you have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. Now, you know, I thought about that and I said, I don't know anybody that you ask, what's your favorite verse? Man, John 16:33. Jesus promises, in this world we're going to have tribulation. Man, I love that promise. We're going to have trials and pain, and what a great promise. You know, I've never seen that on a motivational poster. I've not seen this one in the Christian bookstores. In fact, you know, I've thought about it, and I thought, you know, if I would put a picture with this promise, you're going to have tribulation, you know, what picture do you put with it? And, you know, you look at it and you say, why is it? Now, we may not claim this as one of our favorite verses. We may not put it on the picture with, you know, motivational promise. But the thing is what we realize is all the other ones are true. They're wonderful promises, but this is true as well. And God gives us this as a teaching, in a sense, as a promise, because Jesus is saying, okay, I'm giving this so that you may know you have peace. Because what's going to happen is we're going to go through times of trial and difficulty. And if you don't know that, you'll be surprised by it. You'll be waylaid by it. You'll be destroyed by it. But if you understand, you're not surprised that it's come, then you can find my strength in the middle of it. Well, it's not only that the Bible teaches that we're going to have trial and difficulty. It actually, even if you go deeper, it shows that during some of those times, we're going to struggle. We're going to literally have periods of doubt, that it's something that's inevitable within the Christian life. Let me show you one example of a place where this is taught in the Bible. A well-known verse, James chapter 1, it talks about trials, but look at how it begins, James 1:2. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. Now, first of all, I want you to notice that he says that there is an inevitability of trial. He doesn't say count it joy if you experience trials. It's count it all joy when you meet trials of various kinds. It's going to happen for all of us. And it's also important that he doesn't call us to be joyful. He doesn't say, feel joy, be happy. He says, count it, consider it. It's an intellectual word. Realize it intellectually that you have reason for joy. Even though you don't feel it, you know that there's a reason for this. You know that God has a plan, that he's using this trial to develop a mature faith. And so what's it saying? Continue on. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness, and let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. There's reason to consider it as a cause of joy, even when we don't feel it, because God has his purpose. He's developing a mature faith, and in the midst of this mature faith, as it develops, we will ultimately have a faith that's mature and complete, that doesn't lack anything. But if you study the passage, you see that James himself anticipates there's a problem with this equation. You see, the goal is that at the end of the trial that we would have a perfect and complete faith that lacks nothing. But what about in the middle of the trial? What happens while we're in the middle of the trial when the faith isn't yet stretched? It isn't yet strengthened. It isn't yet complete. We don't have a faith that doesn't lack anything. In fact, we do lack something. And remember, the goal is that at the end we may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing. But in the middle, look what he says. And if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. Literally, what it says, if we were to interpret it literally, if any of you lacks wisdom, which you will, at that point, ask of God. And literally, it's assuming that we all at times will go through trials, and part of that trial will be there will be a lack of wisdom. Now, what's wisdom? Now, wisdom can simply be defined the ability to apply what I know about God and the Bible to the reality of my life at that moment. So if that's wisdom, then what does it mean to lack wisdom in the context of trial? What it means is that there are certain things that I know about God. I know that God is good. I know that God is loving. I know that God has a plan. I know that God is using this to grow my faith. And I know that I have reason literally to consider it joy. But in that moment, I lack the wisdom to actually put that into practice. At that moment, literally what I do is that I begin to doubt. I begin to question, God, I know this is true, but I don't feel it's true. God, I know it's true, but I don't see it playing out in my life. I don't see how you're doing it. Let me even try to illustrate this. I've used this illustration before, but I think it's such a great illustration with this picture. Here's the idea, that if we have a pint-sized faith, and God wants to develop in us a quart-sized faith, what does he do? What he does is he gives us a quart-sized problem. And what happens is when you pour a quart size, I get a half pint faith and I'm okay. And man, I start to get the full pint, problem and I'm really struggling. But then he continues to pour. And what happens is when he continues to pour is it begins to spill over. And you look at that and you say, when we understand that image, what we've got to understand is that's exactly what God is saying he does, is that he wants to develop a deeper faith, a quart-sized faith, and he pours a quart-sized problem into the pint-sized faith, and it spills over. Now, has our faith failed at that time? No. No, the fact is that I had the faith to handle the pint-sized problem, but my faith hasn't failed when it's bigger. The fact is that God gives me more than I can handle because he wants to drive me to a place of crisis to teach me to call out to him in ways that I've never had before. But the only way for me to get to that point of crisis where it stretches my faith is literally to be faced in a situation where I doubt, where I question, where I don't have enough faith to deal with what I'm dealing with. And it's not a failure, it's literally intentional by God. Now here's what we've got to realize. A lot of times people, when they go through this, they feel guilty. Man, I can't doubt God, I can't question that, I can't tell people what I'm thinking. And so we hide it, we feel guilty. And what you've got to realize is that the Bible is saying, no, this is inevitable, this is part of God's plan. You haven't failed, your faith hasn't failed. God is growing your faith, and part of the growth process is trials that literally will overflow our faith in a way that God wants to stretch us and teach us to trust him in ways we've never been forced to do so before. So that's why it teaches, if any of you lacks wisdom, which you will go through these periods, let them ask of God who gives generously to all without finding fault, without reproach, that he doesn't criticize us, he doesn't judge us because we question or because we're struggling. He understands. That's normal. Now, here's what we've got to realize, though, that James is teaching this. We're going to see this here in David. Is these periods where the crisis is bigger than our faith, where it overflows, we're going to doubt, but we can either choose, as James says, to put our faith in what we know to be true, even though we don't feel it, and we struggle, or we can start to put our faith in what we feel and what we see. And these periods, which can be a time of stretching of our faith and growing us to a mature, complete faith, can also be the time of incredible temptation that can destroy us. Now let's see how this plays out in David's life. What we see is that David's struggle now is a long period of time where it seems as if God is silent, and we've all been through that. So let's look at David's life. Let's think about this. We've been studying his life now for an extended period of time, and we saw that when he was a young man, God chose him out. He sent the prophet Samuel to anoint him as the next king. And then he starts with great success. He beats Goliath. He made a general over the army in Israel. He's made the son-in-law of the king. He has all the success. But it suddenly comes to a screeching halt when the king, King Saul, turns on David, becomes jealous of him, and tries to kill him. And after he misses with his own spear, he puts a death warrant on him. And basically, David is the most wanted man in all of Israel. And David escaped at first, but what began is a long period of time of many, many years in which David is now on the run. He is hunted by King Saul, by the authority, and he is just, constantly one step against from Saul. And what we've seen is that there are times that David shows incredible faith and trust in God. And we saw even in the chapters right before we're going to look here today, chapter 24, we see that, that Saul's out. He's got 3,000 men that are out hunting David. And David has an opportunity, in a sense, to turn the tables. And if you remember chapter 24, he's out with 3,000 men. And as he's out looking for Saul, suddenly, or David, Saul has to go to the bathroom. And being the king, he stops the whole army and he says, okay, we're going to take a break now. And he takes his roll of toilet paper and his magazine and he marches up to a cave to get some private time. And he just so happens to choose a cave, which is just so happens to be the very cave where David and his men are further behind. And suddenly, David and his men see Saul here coming in by himself, literally with his pants down, and he has never been more vulnerable. And David and his men, David's men said, David, God has delivered you into Saul into your hands. This is your chance to kill him. This is your chance to take matters in your own hands. And David says, no, that's wrong. This is God's king. I'm not going to take matters in my own hands. I'm going to trust God. So look at David's response. David cuts off a corner of Saul's robe, lets him go back down. And after Saul is with his army, he comes out and he tells Saul what happened. And he screams down to him. Look at verse 11 of chapter 24. See my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. For by the fact that I cut off a corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hand. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you. But my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you. Now you see what he's saying? I'm not going to take it upon my own hand, but may the Lord avenge me. God's going to take care of me. God's going to set the record straight. My faith is in God. Now in the middle of this, then you see Saul look at that, and Saul himself recognizes that not only that he is wrong, but God's going to ultimately raise up David. So look at what Saul says in response, verse 16. As soon as David finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, is this your voice, my son David? And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And he said to David, you are more righteous than I, for you have repaid good, whereas I have repaid you for evil. And you have now declared this day how you dealt with well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put you in your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done with me this day. So Saul's saying, God's going to take care of you. God's going to bless you because of this. Look at what he says in verse 20. And now behold, I know that you shall surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Now this is Saul saying this. And so what a great affirmation for David. God's going to take care of you. But you know what happened? Saul goes back and David's still hunted and nothing seemed to change. So then we saw in chapter 25 last week that, David, I think it's frustrated, and out of that frustration, he takes out some of his anger on Nabal, but God intervenes there and stops him, and through Abigail says, no, wait, let God establish justice. And then chapter 26, something very similar to chapter 24 happens, that again, David has a chance to kill Saul. He refuses to do it. And look at what his words again after sparing Saul's life in chapter 26. David says this, the Lord rewards every man for his righteousness. and his faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hands today that I would put, and I would not put my hand against the Lord's anointed. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, that he may deliver me out of all tribulation. Now you see what he's saying? I trust God. I believe God's going to take care of me. I believe that if I do what's right, God's going to reward me. But the problem is that it continued on, and God didn't deliver him. He's protecting him, but Saul's still hunting him. And so what happens is that I'm going to make you follow along in your Bibles. If you turn to chapter 27, look at what happens next. Finally, after all this time, David has shown such great faith, and now he begins to lose it. Verse 1, then David said in his heart, now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul would despair of seeking me any longer within the border of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand. So David arose and went over, he and 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Mochach, the king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, and he and his men, every man in his household. Now here's what it starts to happen. His theology is, God's in charge. God's going to take care of me. I can trust God. I don't need to take matters into my own hands. But the trial continues to pour, and it begins to overflow. And suddenly now his theology says, is God really good? Is God going to take care of me? Is God ever going to deliver this? And what begins to happen is there's this gap between his theology, what he knows, and his faith, what he actually believes. And he's, you know, what happens is use again the words of James 1, he has this crisis of faith. He lacked wisdom. He lacked the ability to take what he knew about God, what he claimed and proclaimed beforehand, and practically now what he really believes in the midst of his real life. And do you know what he's saying practically when he runs to the Philistines? He's saying, I have more faith in the Philistines to protect me than I do in God. That's what he's saying. So this is a major crisis. But what I want you to see here is that how things develop in David's life. It starts with an overflow of faith. We're all going to go through this. We're all going to go through these times where we have doubt, where we have trial. But it's what we do when we go through these times that determine where the future goes. Will we say, God, I doubt you, I question you, but God, I'm going to choose to believe you even though I don't understand. We're going to say, I need to figure this out myself. God isn't trustworthy. Now, unfortunately, what we see here with David is he takes the latter approach. He's believed God. He knows these are true. But now in that doubt, he begins to say, God, maybe you aren't trustworthy. And you see him going down a path that starts with doubt that ultimately leads to destruction and dysfunction. So let's see how this goes. See, first of all, for all of us, where it starts with David, where it starts with us, we start with doubt. But it's doubt that where we not only doubt God's promises, but even his goodness. Where it's not just, God, I don't see you, but we start to say, God, do you really keep your promises? Are you good? What did he say before? I believe that God will take care of me if I do righteous. I believe that God will reward me. See, when we think about our doubt, you know where it starts is we start to say, is God really powerful? Is God really good? Is God really trustworthy? Because I've been trying to do what's right, but God isn't keeping his part of the bargain. So maybe God isn't trustworthy. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 talks about the importance of faith, and look at how it defines faith. It says, it is impossible to please God without faith. Anyone who wants to come to him must believe that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. So faith isn't just believing that there's a God, but it's also believing that God is good, that God is trustworthy. It's believing that he rewards those who seek him, that if we do what's right, if we seek after him, God will in time take care of us. And what happens is when we begin to have doubt, if we start to say, not only is this doubt, but I'm starting to doubt the character of God, the trustworthiness of God. It's not only that I'm doubting whether God's there, I'm doubting whether God is good. And so that's where David starts. That's where we start. And when we start to doubt God's goodness, God's trustworthiness, what then happens is we go from there to humanistic reasoning. So look at what happens here in David at the beginning of verse 1. If you look there in 37:1, and David said in his heart. Now, up until now, what David's been doing is he's been seeking after God. He's been calling after God. He's been, you know, calling the prophets. He's been praying. He's saying, God, give me leadership. Give me direction. And he's been committed to God's promises. He's been committed to God's cause. And he's been trusting in God's goodness. But what you have here is that he starts to doubt whether God is really there, whether God will keep his word. And instead of expressing confidence in God, he starts to say, well, maybe I can't rely on God. And if I can't rely on God, then I have to figure it out myself. And what we find from here up until the end of or chapter 30, there's no mention of David praying. In this whole section of David's life, almost a year and a half, there's no mention of any psalms that were written in this period of David's life. What you have happening is there's no record of him calling on God in any way, because what you see is that him saying, if God isn't trustworthy, then I've got to figure it out myself. If God isn't going to take care of me, if God isn't going to deliver me from Saul, well, I've got to fix it myself. And again, we do the same thing. God, if you aren't going to fix this, if you aren't going to provide this, God, I've been praying for this, and if you're not going to give me what I need, then, well, then I've got to take care of it myself. I've got to take it upon myself, and how can I make it work? See, because what happens is when we start thinking from a humanistic standpoint, we take God out of the equation, it's going to lead to some pessimistic projection. And we see this again with David. David said, verse 1, David said in his heart, now I shall perish one day by the hand of the Lord. Basically says, you know, one day Saul's going to catch me. I'm going to keep running. One day, you know, I'm one step ahead of him, but one day I'm going to miss that one step and he's going to get me. You see, if he looked in the past, what would happen? If he looked in the past from the day that he was anointed as the future king, all the way through his battle with Goliath, all the battles he had fought before, and all the way that God had protected him supernatural over the years, he would say, if I look backward, man, all I see is God's protection, God's provision. God has been there every step of the way. But now he's looking in the present. He said, I don't see it right now. I don't see how it's working out. And he's now projecting into the future, and he's saying, because I don't see it now, well, how can I trust God in the future? And so whereas before he looked to God and he said, because I know that God is there, I know that God will take care of it. Now he says, well, now I can't trust on God. And when we take God out of the equation, then we start to think we're victims of circumstances, and we start to think, oh, the worst is going to happen unless I do something. We start thinking pessimistically, you know, we start to fear the worst. We assume the worst. I ran across even somebody that they said an example of pessimism. Dustin Hoffman once said, he wants that the following words on his tombstone. I knew this was going to happen. You know, it's kind of like that, you know, that idea. I knew this was going to happen. And well, we're all going to die. Yes, that's true. But David's like, I know this is going to happen. And all the confidence that he had in the past, all the promises. In fact, there were numerous places what we saw, you know, Samuel, God anointed him and said, you're going to be king. God spoke through Jonathan, and Jonathan said, I knew you were going to be king. God spoke through Abigail, I knew you were going to be king. We saw just in chapter 24, God spoke through Saul and said, I know that one day you're going to be king. God's taken care of him. God's proclaimed that, but he's lost sight of that. And here's what happens when we lose sight of God, we will become more pessimistic. And I want to tell you, if I, you know, we've said even before, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in our problems and our culture and all the bad news. And I always believed, you know, if I spend most of my time in the newspaper, then I'm gonna get discouraged and pessimistic. If I spend a lot of time in the good news, the timeless news of God's truth, I'm gonna be optimistic. And the problem is that if we get caught up in humanistic thinking, we start to get more and more negative. And when we get more and more negative, then we start to rationalize things. And we justify our rationalization. Look at what David does. First of all, we saw in verses 1 and 2, David said in his heart, now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me than I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I'll escape out of his hand. Now, what's he saying? Okay, well, if it's going to be terrible and God isn't in the equation, okay, what can I do? And he comes up with a conclusion that is a major compromise. But it's rationalized. It's, this is the way it's going to work. You know what? Saul, who's Saul's enemies? Well, if his enemy is my friend, and you know we have a common enemy, so if I go there, then Saul's going to kind of leave me alone. But it's important to know what's happening here. See, he's not just saying, okay, I'm going to find a safe place to live. When he's doing this, he's saying, I trust the Philistines more than I trust God to protect me. When he's doing this, he's literally making a decision to align himself with the enemies of God's people. And he's compromising in a significant way. Now look at verse 5, if you have your Bibles open. Then David said to Achish, "If I have found favor in your eyes, then let a place be given to me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" Now here's what's happening. He's entering into a covenant, into a contract with Achish, the king of Gath, of the Philistines. And the terms are, you know, I'm going to pledge my loyalty to you. And if I pledge my loyalty to you, then you're going to give me a small town to live in. And he is firmly associating himself with the enemies of God's people. Now, what you see then is that this justification of rationalization leads to then significant compromise over time. Because look at what happens. Verse 6, that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. And the number of days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was a year and 4 months. And at first, he just runs away for a little while, but next thing you know, he settles there. And what seemed to be a short-term solution becomes very comfortable. And next thing you know, he's settling where he's identifying. He's totally forgotten about God. He's identifying with God's enemies. And he compromises in ways that he couldn't have dreamed beforehand. And it's not only that, but this dysfunctional decision that he makes impacts other people as well. And it always is for all of us. You know, we like to think that, well, this is just my decision. It's just me in between God. And no, there is nothing that we ever do that only impacts us. It will always impact those around us. Look at what happens with David. He not only goes to Gath, but he brought 600 men who were following him and their whole families. Verse 2. So David arose and went over, and he and 600 men who were with him to Achish, the son of Moab, the king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nathal's widow. So see, here what you see is that we've got to realize, not only David, with all of us, every time we choose a path of sin, it always impacts other people. And the fact is that, you know, we like to think, well, it's just my decision, it's just private. No, it's never that's the case. It always impacts other people. And we see this very clearly here with David. Now, when you look at this, this is a path that started out with a little compromise. We all go through periods of doubt. It's not that the doubt is wrong, but it's a doubt that begins to question God, that begins to dwell on it, becomes humanistic in its perspective, and suddenly you see it down a path of compromise where suddenly his life is a mess. And look at the effects of that, because there are always effects when we walk down this path. Now, the effects at first don't seem to be significant. In fact, if you look at David's life, and often the case for us, at first it seems to work. At first there's a false sense of security here for David. Look at verse 4. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. And so David looks at this and says, this accomplished the goal. You know, I wanted to get Saul to stop chasing after me, so I go over here and man, I'm free now. But his security was not based in his faith in God's protection. His security was based in his faith in the Philistines' protection. See, God's protection was unseen. And it was there. It was always there. And God had always taken care of him. But the Philistine protection was seen. And that's a whole lot more reliable. And here's what we need to realize. See, when we choose a path of sin, it's not only protection. It's what do we believe will satisfy us? What do we think will take care of our need? What do you think will solve our problems? And the problem with temptation is always this, is that the promises of the world are seen. And if we do this, well, this happens, and I can have some control over that, and it's always seen. But the promises of God are unseen. And there are times that we seek after God, and we obey God, and we don't see the results right away. And because of that, it's easy to say, well, let me go for what seems to work. But it's a false sense of security. Because we see here with David, it's security, but that it ultimately led to a diluted sense of morality. Because the more that we think without God, the more that our discernment of what's right and wrong begins to become diluted. And look at where David went with this. Look at verse 8 and 9 of chapter 37. Now David and his men went up and made raids against the Gershites and the Gizrahites and the Amalekites. For these were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away the sheep and the oxen and donkeys and camels and the garments and come back to Achish. Now here's what happened. In order to have income, you know, what they decided to do is to raid various small towns. And this was common in that day. That's what you saw in the beginning, why they called the king was because the Philistines were raiding the Israelite towns all the time and taking all their possessions. And so David says, well, I'm going to do that. But what he does is he begins to raid towns that were not Philistines, but they were not Israel as well. And they were kind of neutral groups. And to do that, you know, he wants to now claim, you know, get Achish to think that he's firmly in the control of the Philistines. So he begins to tell him that what he's doing is he's actually raiding Israelite towns. But so that it never gets back what he's actually doing, he starts to kill all the people in the towns that he's raiding. He doesn't just steal their stuff. He kills everyone so that it never gets back what he's actually doing. And what he's doing here is he's justifying behavior. This is murder. This is what he's doing is terrible. You know, there are times that God would send out an army and say, okay, I want you to attack them for this reason and because of their sin. This isn't something God is commanding them to do. This is in no way right. But David is justifying amazing compromise based on, you know, he's not thinking about God, and it works. Continue on, verse 10 and 11. When Achish asks, where have you made a raid today? David would say, against Negeb or Judah, or against the Negeb of the Jerusalemites, or against the Negeb of the Kenites. And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking lest they should tell about us and say, so has David done. So was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines. So he knows what he's doing is wrong. And when he would be asked, he would kind of give this vague answer. Well, against this general area, giving the impression that it's against the Israelites, but in the whole time that it's, you know, that it's against this neutral group. And so what you see is this incredible compromise, and David's blind to it. And he's compromising morally, and he's now going out and murdering people, and he's justified it, and he's blind to the fact of how far away he has come, gone away from God. But what you also see is that when we walk down this path that starts with doubt and that leads to, you know, that leads to compromise and ultimately dysfunction, it also leads to destruction. Because the fact of the matter is that there are always significant consequences. We can't see them in the beginning. The fact is, I know the pastor I was raised under would always say one of his favorite quotes, truth and time go hand in hand. And it's true, truth and time go hand in hand. We do things, and the truth always catches up to us. And look at what happens here. You know, that he, you know, makes these decisions, but the consequences come due. Look at, first of all, if you go to chapter 27, verse 12. It says, and Achish trusted David, thinking he has made himself an utter stench to his people. Therefore, he shall always be my servant. And so he's saying, well, I'm getting away with this. But then look what happens. Go to chapter 28. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, understand that you and your men are to go with me into the army. And David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. Now here's everything's going great. And he's lying until there's a battle. And the Philistines form their whole armies, and Achish says, you're part of my town now. You're part of the people that are loyal to me, so you're part of my army to go attack Israel. Now, his deception has worked, but suddenly now he's in a catch-22. I mean, he can't say, no, I'm not going to attack my people, but if he joins the army and he attacks Israel, he will forever be a stench. He will never be able to be a king. He will ever be rejected. But if he says, well, I'm not going to do it, and if he, you know, fails to do that, then what happens is everybody in the Philistines see that he's, you know, he's been faking it the whole time, and they're going to turn on David and his men. And so what happens is that he's caught, and there's no answer. And you see what it says, you know, well, you know, you'll see what your servant can do. And he interprets this as the king interprets this as a statement of loyalty. But you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, there is no win in this for David. You know what's amazing is that it stops here and then it goes to the story of Samuel or Saul. And I think it's almost even the writer saying, okay, let me just let you hang there. that this is a crisis, and it is, David is in serious trouble. Now then what happens is that we go to the beginning of chapter 30 and we see that, you know, that they basically let him off. No, we're not going to make you go fight. But now go to chapter 30, verse 1. And when David and his men came to Ziklag, so they come back to their, and on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negeb of, against the Ziklag, and against Ziklag. and they'd have overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and had taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. And when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. And David and the people were with him, raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength. Look at verse 6. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each to his own son and daughter. Now again, remember, who has he been raiding before? The Amalekites. And who comes and raids him now? The Amalekites. Is that a big surprise? No. And so what you have happening, I've been getting away with this, and kind of let him off the hook here, but now the bills come due, and the people that you thought that you've been taking, getting away with raiding them, suddenly they know who you are, and they've raided you, and they've taken their whole family. And we're told here that David and his men, they were distressed, and the people were ready to kill him. They were ready to kill him. Now, that's how desperate things had gotten. But I want you to see in this that, just in closing, that as desperate as the path may be, as far away from God as we may get, there's always an offer for grace and hope and healing. There's always, if we can get on the wrong path, then there's always a path of escape through God's grace. Now we look at this, and what we may see is that David sees these incredible consequences. Life is falling apart. I mean, everybody, his families, all their families have been taken captive. People are ready to kill him. And he can look at that and he can get angry. He can respond in any way. He can continue to try to figure out things his own way. Or he could realize that, sometimes God uses these consequences not because he's mad at us, not because he wants to hurt us, but to get our attention. And that's what David sees here. God uses consequences to get our attention. And you might be here in your life and you might be, man, I've wandered away from God. I'm doing this. And life is falling apart. And you could get mad. God, why aren't you doing this? What I want you to realize is that sometimes those painful times are God's way of getting our attention and saying, I want your attention. I want you to realize what you're doing. You're on the wrong path and it's leading you to destruction. And this is a warning sign. It doesn't have to destroy you. Look at what it says in Hebrews chapter 12. And have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the ones whom he loves. He chastises everyone whom he receives. For it is discipline that you have had to endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son whom there is their father who does not discipline? And if you are left without discipline, in which all participated, then you are illegitimate children, not sons. Literally, it's saying, if you're walking a path of sin and God's not disciplining you, then you got to watch out because you might not even be saved. Verse 9, beside this, we have all had earthly fathers who disciplined us and we respected them. Shall we now not much more be subject to the Father of our spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our own good, that we may share in his holiness. For at the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Now that's what we realize, is that God uses consequence to get our attention. And we may be here, you may be angry, you might be frustrated. If you're in that path, if you're feeling the consequences, that's not God who's angry at you, not God who's rejecting you. That may be God pursuing you as a father and saying, I want to get your attention so that you come back to me. And look what happens with David. Is he comes back. If you have your Bibles open, look what it says in verse 6 again of chapter 30. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord. See, God always offers grace to all who turn to him. It doesn't matter how far away we've gone. It doesn't matter how lost we've been. It doesn't matter how, David's been out killing people. Doesn't matter how much we have wandered away from God. God is not here to say, I'm here to get you. I'm here to catch you. I'm here. But God's here to say, yes, I will catch you. I will point out your sin. There will be consequences, not so that I can judge you, but that I can forgive you. And even with David, as we may be broken in the point of saying, even here, that finally David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Finally, he turns after God. Finally, he starts asking God questions. He starts praying again. And while it doesn't totally fix all the consequences at that moment, what you see is God begin to put his life back together, put him on the right path, a path of healing and restoration, and ultimately a path of honoring and serving God. Now, my friends, the good news is, again, no matter where we are at, no matter how far away that you've gone, The fact is that we've never left the path of God to the point that we can not return. We never go to a path where God says, man, you're so far gone, man, I just reject you. I hate you now. I'm out to get you. That even in some of the pain, even in the frustration, it's God pursuing us. As the prodigal son, the father would pursue that prodigal son, he pursues us. And he calls us to come to him because he offers grace to all who will turn to him. No matter where you're at today, if you're just at the beginning of that path, if you're in the middle of doubt, you know, say, God, help me to trust in you. Help me to not put my faith in that. If you started to turn down that path and you started in the human reasoning and you're still in the beginning, man, now is the time to turn to God before you walk all the way down it. Or if you have been walking down that path and you're at all the way to the dysfunction and destruction and your life is a mess now, God says, turn to me. If you turn to me, I will forgive you and I will start to help give you the ability to start to put it back together. We turn to him today because he offers grace to all who will.
Thanks for watching. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, or church, feel free to reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. The links are in the description.